Hi, I'm Adrienne Hill, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of October 18th, 2013. We start today with a lesson in personal finance, or more specifically, a lesson in why there are so few lessons in personal finance. According to a new survey, 99% of us think schools ought to teach the basics. Like, you know, budgets, debts, defaulting on our obligations, anyone? But a lot of schools never touch it. To explain the discrepancy between what we want and what we actually do, we've invited author and Time magazine contributor Dan Kadlec to join us. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
So how common are personal finance classes in schools around the country?
Not common at all. Something like 14 states have a requirement for some kind of personal finance in the curriculum. Most of what's offered is as an elective. There's something like 4 states that actually require a personal finance course. So not very common at all.
And why so few, considering 99% nearly all of us want this education in our schools?
You know, 20 years ago, this term financial literacy, financial education, it barely even existed.
Huh.
It's only in the last really 5 years since the recession that policymakers and leaders have decided we need better personal finance education to as a safeguard against another meltdown. And so there, you know, so programs have begun to spring up, but it's still a fairly new movement, and we're trying to figure out what works.
What are the roadblocks to making it happen?
Well, there are many. There are something like 1,400 studies that are contradictory or inconclusive. Teachers themselves don't really understand how to teach the subject. You've got people that are starting to develop a backlash because there's so little evidence that personal finance knowledge actually changes behavior.
So one thing I found fascinating in the survey that came out is that nearly 4/5 of adults think learning about personal finance is hard. And the reason a lot of them give is because there are actually too many education resources out there. And it struck me as a little counterintuitive, a little, that too many resources are muddling things up.
Well, that's right. And that's a very recent development. 10 years ago, there weren't enough. Today, there may be too many. It's a disjointed effort. There's not a lot of continuity to the programs, and a lot of it's regional or local. What we don't have is any real national leadership. We don't have any real ability to decide what is the program and what isn't. There are 4 states that have a standalone personal finance course required for high school graduation. I mean, I think that's a model.
And so, at a national level, what do you think? Where does it go from here? Where should it go from here?
Well, where we should be headed is towards some sort of a mandate for personal finance education in schools. Now, Great Britain just approved that. They're starting in 2014. Australia has mandatory financial ed in their schools. There's a bunch of other countries that are moving that way quickly, including Canada. It's a global thing, and we're not getting there, largely because education is dealt with at the state level, so we don't have any federal authority that can say you have to do this. Now the states are thinking about it; they want to do it, but it's really hard to get them all together with a common initiative.
Who could do that? Who could sort of make this happen? Do you think?
Wow, that's a good question. In England, they have sort of a national figure, and they also have a federal authority. Australia, they also have a federal authority. It's really going to be up to the states to come together, probably with some kind of federal leadership.
In the meantime, what advice would you have for listeners who do want to start learning personal finance, who are a little overwhelmed by the options out there?
I would start with some of the there's a few federal websites, mymoney.gov and moneyasyoulearn.org. 2 good places to sort of get a grounding for what you should know and at what age.
I want to shift just slightly here and ask, you know, we've been talking a lot about the national debt. And I wonder if there's a way you'd suggest families or teachers use this moment in the country's history as a personal finance teaching moment for kids.
Look, John and Jill, here's how you don't do it. it's an interesting question because the government is a lot different than families, not least being that they can print dollars. They don't have to earn them. But it is a good way to just bring up the subject.
Dan Cadillac is co-author of A New Purpose, Redefining Money, Family, Work, Retirement, and Success. Thanks so much.
Anytime.
And we'll have the links to the sites Dan mentioned at marketplacemoney.org. Click on Personal Finance in Schools. As Dan just told us, there isn't a standard personal finance curriculum in the U.S., which leaves a lot of folks wondering about the basics. When to buy a home? How much can you pull out of your portfolio? Also, if we've learned anything from the finally resolved government shutdown, it's the importance of an emergency fund. But how big should that be? Well, today, class is in session. At the chalkboard, Jill Schlesinger. She's here to weigh in on some of your questions. She's a CBS News business analyst and a regular contributor to our program. Hey, Jill.
Hello.
So we've got a caller on the line, Sarah in New London, New Hampshire. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call.
So what's fall like in New Hampshire? How's this time of year?
It's beautiful this time of year. It's bright sunshine and crisp nights and gorgeous leaves.
You have good color this year?
Yes, it was good this year.
That's great. Well, tell us what's going on.
My husband and I have always been told that a rule of thumb for saving for retirement is to save enough to replace 80% of our salary. Is that 80% sort of from the pre-tax salary or the take-home salary? And the difference for us is that we're actually taking out quite a large percentage of our income from retirement. So for us, that's a big difference.
Jill, take it away.
This is a great question. I hate these rules of thumb, so I'm going to give you the better answer, which is if you know how much money you're spending right now, then it's pretty easy. You can figure it out and say, hey, we'll probably spend about that much money when we retire, unless there's something big going to happen in your retirement. You're going to downsize dramatically. You're going to move into a hovel or something. But presumably, when we look at those retirement expenses, we do it net of your retirement contributions, because you won't be doing that in the future. The
right.
One thing, though, you may be doing is having a little bit more money to be spending on health care.
And now we currently are raising two children and have all of those, you know, raising children costs that hopefully we will not have in retirement. But then you're saying we would maybe have health care that would be more expensive?
Yeah, I mean, look, you get Medicare when you retire. There is also a cost for any sort of supplemental Medicare, which can run somewhere around, let's just say, $1,000 a month for a couple.
Sarah, how are you thinking about saving for retirement and paying these kids' costs, which I assume college is a big one for you?
That's the big issue, is that we've done a good job, we think, saving for retirement, because we have also heard the rule of thumb of pay yourself for retirement first and then save for college. But now with two children who are teenagers, we're looking at now moving a good bit of that retirement savings into college savings.
Good or bad idea, Jill? What do you say?
Let's talk about the numbers. How much money have you saved for retirement already?
Well, we've saved enough to, we have this little spreadsheet that we use. We probably are very close to being able to replace our current spending level.
And you said you had two kids, and just where are they in the process of pre-college?
Very little time. One is, they're both in high school. One is a freshman and one is a senior.
Where are you guys coming down on paying for or helping your children pay for school?
We would like to pay for most of it, with the exception of student loans.
So are you saying that if you were to reduce or even stop contributing to your retirement plans, the money that you would have could fund college fully for the kids?
It would actually fund a state school fully.
And how old are you guys?
50.
There's two different approaches to this. You know, you've already socked away a lot of money for retirement. One approach might be to say, hey, I'll just keep putting money in. And if I need money for college, I'll just borrow against my retirement plan.
Mm-hmm.
Another is to say, you know what? I've really done a good job. I'll pull my contributions back a little bit and use that rest of that money to pay out of pocket as you go along. And I don't think there's a big problem with that. But I guess that if you've done the spreadsheet and you've done the projections and you feel comfortable with it, that's fine. I am always reluctant to just stop contributing, though, I must say.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it's some token amount, 5% or so, just to keep the money flowing there, even if it's just for tax purposes to reduce your taxable income, because remember, now you're going to get all this money after tax. So your tax bracket could maybe even go up. So
yes,
just to be careful about that.
Yeah, I think it really could go up if we stopped contributing completely to pre-tax.
Yeah, and I just, you know, I don't think it's like, and if you come up short, especially for the freshman, you know, if you had five more years before you needed to access that second chunk of money, you know, you really could always do a loan against your retirement accounts if you have loan provisions, and most big plans do, and you can help pay for that. And you can also sort of see what kind of students these kids are going to be, because I don't necessarily know if I want to, like, have you stop all your retirement contributions if your kids are going to state school and going to party their butts off for 4 years. Sorry. Is that that's the mean aunt.
No, I hope that they're not that type of student, but one really never knows. But at this point,
exactly.
They don't seem to be that type of student.
Now, have you talked to your kids about the cost of college?
Yes, we've spoken around the dinner table, I guess you might say. So we haven't had an in-depth conversation, but they understand that their job is to get into as good a college as they can get into, and they know that they will be doing loans, and then our job is to help them cover that.
And why are you thinking about this today?
Well, mostly because my daughter's a senior, and we've been putting in college applications. So we sort of took a little, I think it's one of these things that we kept putting off until it was sort of too late to put it off. We really have to think about it now.
Sarah, has this helped at all?
Oh, yes. It's helped a lot. I'm thinking of talking about this new rule of thumb about spending about the same amount as what we spend now, and taking health care into account for that, and then options for either continuing to contribute and then borrowing against a retirement plan, which I actually know my husband's plan does have that option. And then the other thing is to maybe narrow down the contributions very low, but just keep putting something in and funnel the rest towards college.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for your call. Thank you for listening to the show. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. I love your show. Thanks for having me on.
Stay with us for more stories about money. We'll continue to answer your personal finance questions, including this one about the future.
Tell us when you're going to die, and then we can build you a beautiful financial plan. You know, there is actually a website. I am not kidding you. There's a website that's called, I think it's called livingto100.com.
Mirror, mirror on the financial wall. That's coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Adrienne Hill. My guest this hour is Jill Schlesinger. She's a CBS News business analyst, and she's answering your personal finance questions. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So let's get right back to our callers. We have Kayla with us from Berwyn, Pennsylvania. Hey, Kayla.
Hey there.
So walk us through your question. What's going on?
Well, I am 57. I worked in the corporate world for 25 years. Saved my money and took advantage of the miracle of compounding interest. And then I left the corporate world about 10 years ago to do something completely different and now run my own small businesses. I currently earn only about $30,000 a year after taxes. My expenses are at about $60,000, so I'm taking $30,000 a year from my portfolio. My question is, can I continue to do this and be okay through retirement, or am I living in fantasy land and should go get a real job again?
It's so fun in fantasy land, though.
It is.
And what's a real job mean to you?
Well, the corporate world was your basic 50, 60-hour work week in an office and high stress and all that kind of thing, and I'd really rather not go back to that.
What do you think, Jill?
Well, how much money did you squirrel away when you were working for the man?
My portfolio is at about $740,000.
Mm-hmm. That expense number, when you said $60,000 a year, are those fixed expenses, or is there any squish room in that? Is it possible that we could drive it down to 50, or is it a real 60?
It's a real 60 now, but it will drop down to about 50 in 2016 between, hopefully, the health care stuff, and my son will be graduating from college, with a degree in electrical engineering, so I'm hoping he'll actually be able to get a job.
Awesome. He will definitely get a job. Okay. So, you know, interesting, because I'm going to round up because I have to be able to do this math in my head. $750,000. One of the easiest ways to kind of say, well, how much can I take from that portfolio every year and not drain it would be to apply something that we call a withdrawal rate. And, you know, this is a huge contested issue in financial planning. When I first got into the business 100 years ago, they would say, oh, you could pull 6% of the value of your portfolio out every year and you'd be fine. Of course, that was when stocks were rising by 10 or 12% a year. I think now conventional wisdom says you could pick somewhere around 3 or 3.5% a year as a withdrawal rate. And, you know, you're probably going to be okay. So if I do a 3% of 750,000, I get to 22.5-ish. If I do 3.5%, I get to 26-ish. And that's about what you're doing, right? You're kind of pulling out this extra money. You're doing a little bit more than that, but for a few years, it wouldn't kill you to do it. In my mind, you're probably going to be okay. You know, you'll keep working. You'll continue to make money. Hopefully, you'll make a little bit more money. And when those expenses drop to $50,000, then the numbers actually look a lot better. So I don't want to, like, make you move out of fantasy land. I say that you sit up on that pink cloud and enjoy the view of us mere mortals working in the rat race.
That sounds wonderful.
That's the best advice I've heard you give anyone, Jill.
Thank you very much. You know, look, I just want to say that it is clear that, you know, if we have 10 years in a row where things were horrible, or if you had a huge downward trend in the market, it would be better if you could somehow force yourself to spend a little less in those kinds of years. That does make a difference. But, you know, overall, I think you should be okay. And it sounds like if you love what you're doing, you can keep doing it for a lot longer. And so, frankly, if you can keep working longer, that's one of the best ways to juice up your retirement anyway.
Well, yeah, my plan is to work and retire at 70. And at that point, my Social Security should be right around $29,000 a year. So I should basically be able to replace my working income with the Social Security. I do have a small pension that's frozen at $2,700 a year that would start at age 65. And they just now offered me the option to take it as a lump sum at $25,700 now. And when I run the numbers, it kind of depends on how long I live, which one makes more sense.
Tell us when you're going to die, and then we can build you a beautiful financial plan. You know, there is actually a website. I am not kidding you. There's a website that's called, I think it's called livingto100.com, livingto100.com. And you can plug in kind of like your family history, and it will give you a better estimate of when you will die. And then you could
and then
actually
you can plan
with that.
Around it.
Yeah, you could sort of at least when they ask you your life expectancy, rather than plugging in sort of a standard 90 or 95 if you're under the age of 50, you could put in something that more approximates your real number. But who knows? There's two schools of thought about that. I'm sure that, you know, the longer you live, taking the annual pension is better. On the other hand, having control of that lump sum today might give you some comfort to kind of beef up the amount of money in your retirement assets. And if it's really six, one half dozen the other, you go with like, hey, maybe I'd like a little bit of extra consistent income versus, give me the 25 G's right now.
Okay, great.
Kayla, I didn't ask you before about the business that you do now that you do like, the non-corporate man job.
Well, I have two businesses. The main one is it's a dog exercising business. And it's not dog walking, it's dog exercise. So we specialize in an hour of high-level cardio exercise for dogs.
So what does that mean?
We take dogs to the park. And we spend an hour at the park, and we're running, hiking, swimming, chasing things, all kinds of stuff. So they get the mental stimulation as well as the physical exercise. So when we take them back home, they are very tired and very happy.
That does sound like a great job.
I feel like I want that to sign up for myself.
You could start a franchise right now, yeah.
They see how happy their dogs are. They say, can I go alone?
And what's your plan in retirement? What are you going to do after this?
Well, I want to get more involved in volunteer work and probably some traveling. But I do. I own two dogs, and one of my dogs and I are a certified pet therapy team. So I'm in the process of getting to go with her to a rehab hospital to do some pet therapy work there. And I'm also getting involved in a local youth mentoring group. And I would just really like to get more and more involved in that kind of stuff.
As you think about, I mean, it seems like you've made choices to step out of the corporate world and now thinking about this really interesting volunteer work that you're hoping to do in retirement. Do you feel good about the choices you've made so far?
Yes. I left the corporate world because I'd gotten pretty burnt out, and they were moving my office into Center City, which would have meant longer commutes and time away from my son. So I decided that that was the kick in the butt I needed to go do something completely different. And I have never regretted it.
Kayla, thank you so much. It's a good story. You're doing great, it sounds like.
Thank you for taking my call.
I appreciate it. All right, Jill, we have an email for you now.
Okay.
Arthur wrote in from West Tisbury, Massachusetts. He inherited a home in another state just as the economy and the housing market sputtered. He's waiting for the market to improve before he sells it, and he wants to know, when's it going to be time to put the house back on the market? Is it today? Is it later? What do you say?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, this is a crystal ball question, and you know, his crystal ball in Martha's Vineyard might be just as good as mine in New York City. Most people put their homes on the markets when they have to, right? They say, I've inherited this home and I need the money, or we have to settle the estate, and they just have to fire sale the house. He's not in that situation. So that said, what do we know? We know that the housing market has been improving, and we bottomed out at the beginning of 2012. We've had 12% year-over-year increases in the last few months, and that's been really good. I think that the pace of price increases nationally is going to likely slow down, but the housing market should continue to firm. So the question is, what's it costing him to carry that house versus how much more do we think he can make by just being patient? Part of this has to do with how much of a burden this is to actually have this thing kicking around,
right?
And what's going on in the local economy where the other house is. So, you know, you usually have a lot of different variables, and it is a timing issue. It's one of those times where we say, you know, we say never time the market, except when you have to time the market. And this is a market timing question. So, you know, if you can be a little bit patient, it's not costing you a lot to carry the house, that I think that things will improve. But if you feel like, you know what, I've gotten a lot of the gains back from the middle of the worst part of this, and I'm comfortable with that, then go ahead and sell it. It's again, a bit of this is emotional, how much you feel like this is weighing you down.
And are there pitfalls here he should avoid?
You know, it's funny. I used to think that the best idea in the world was to go off and sell your house on your own, because you would save yourself all that commission. And what I have learned in my many, many, many years as being the daughter of a realtor is that my mother would hate when I would say things like that. But you know what? I think that listing a home with a really good realtor who's going to market your property and be very proactive and be honest with you. You know, you don't want to hire the realtor who's basically going to tell you what you want to hear. Hey, your house is worth way more than you thought. You want the person who looks you in the eye and says, Joe says it's way more than it's worth. Here's what the price is that we can move it. Here's what I'm going to do to market it. Here's my online strategy. Here's my physical strategy. And here's why I think you should give the listing to me. So do your research on a broker. Don't just hire the broker who your hairdresser told you to hire. Talk to these people and find out what they're going to do. You're going to pay them a lot of money, 5 or 6%. So make sure they're going to deliver the goods.
Any mistakes that you've made buying and selling property that you're willing to fess up to?
You know what? I would say that my biggest mistake in buying a property that it's funny because they said this came from West Tisbury. So I owned a property on Martha's Vineyard myself. So that's why I knew where it was. And my mistake there was not understanding that the nature of the block that I was on was such that it was an access road where people brought their boats to go to this lake. And I thought, oh, I'm near the lake. That's so awesome. And I never thought that at 5 o'clock in the morning, the fishermen were coming down and going boom, 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 boom down the street. So it just tells you that, you know, you should. I think that now what I've learned is I always talk to people in the neighborhood. I've bought and sold things since then. And I've talked to people in the neighborhood. If you live in a big city, ask the questions on the ground. I think that can save you a lot of heartache down the road.
All right. Thanks so much, Jill. Stay with us for just a minute. We're going to be right back with another listener email. email from a woman named Mary in Michigan. And let me set this up a little. She's 60 years old. She's a widow. She lives in Michigan. She wants to move to Chicago where her family is. And her first question is, she's heard that you shouldn't buy a home until you sell the home you have. But she's worried if she waits, she's not going to be able to get in at a good price. So what do you say?
You know, it kind of depends on how much money you have. If Mary's got $10 million socked away and she wants to carry two $500,000 homes, okay, I can live with that. Do we know what her net worth is about?
Yeah, I think she's got about $1 million.
She's got $1 million, which is a good chunk of money. She's 60 years old, and we now know our rule of thumb, which is the withdrawal rate
yes.
that we can apply to that is, you know, somewhere around she'll have 30 grand a year that can come in. Okay,
3 to 3.5%, right?
That's right. 3 to 3.5%. So I'll go 3% because I'll be err on the side of being conservative.
Okay.
She can pull 30 grand from that. I don't know if she has a pension or not, but it would not make me happy as the advisor to have a big chunk of that $1 million tied up in a second home. The first answer is no, you do not buy the second home until you sell the first home.
Okay.
And I know that that can be very frustrating to people, and they might feel like prices are getting much more expensive in the place I want to be. It's still a more prudent course of action to sell your house, then buy the next house.
Even if it's frustrating, go ahead and try to wait it out.
I think so. I really do. And you know what? It takes a while to sell houses. And every time that we hear from people who say, I sold my house in one day, you hear four more stories of it took 6, 8, 12 months.
Mm-hmm. So another part of Mary's email she wrote, she said, this is all new to me since my husband did so much of the money stuff. And her husband, again, has passed away. She writes, I'm so scared I'll do the wrong thing.
Oh,
yeah.
That makes me sad. Well, you know, she doesn't have to be so scared. I think that this is such a great example, and we hear these stories all the time. Widows and widowers who are left behind, who are really not the family chief financial officer. They might be the CEO of the family. They might be the chief marketing officer. They
right.
might be the chief operating officer, but they're not the financial officer of the family. And, you know, it just drives home the point that, you know, I know that no matter what, you think you're 40 years old, you're 30 years old, you're 20 years old, you think nothing bad's going to happen to you, but something bad could happen to you. So I really do recommend, it's okay to allocate labor, right? You are going to take care of the finances,
right.
honey. You do that really well. But you've got to check in with your mate, the non-CFO. You've got to check in and say, look, here's our game plan. Here's what our portfolio is. The non-CFO spouse will often be like, I don't want to know about it.
Exactly.
You're doing a good job.
Please
and
leave
so
me
you,
out of it.
Leave me out of it. And the answer to that is, you know what? I don't want to have to worry that you will be left feeling scared and anxious about money. I mean, look at this. A woman is 60 years old. She's got $1 million. And there's no reason why she needs to feel scared about this.
Right.
If you are someone who manages your money on your own and you don't have an advisor, something that is really a very interesting thing to consider is as you're getting older, is you might want to pay a fee-only advisor to help bring that conversation to fruition, to say, sit down and say, hey, I'd like another set of eyes. And then when you're gone, if your spouse doesn't really want to do it, there is an advisor there waiting to help. Again, a fee-only advisor, maybe someone hourly at the beginning. But imagine if Mary could turn around and say, hey, Adrian, remember I met with you 2 years ago? Well, unfortunately, my husband has passed away. I really liked you. I felt like really confident in the information you were able to communicate to me. I would like to hire you not just by the hour. I would actually like to hire you to manage this $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a much more seamless way to bridge this gap. So the conversation has to happen. The conversation has to happen with, if you're working with an advisor, you bring the non-CFO spouse in to really get that person on the same page. If they are reluctant to do so, pull the guilt card. It works. You know, I don't want to worry about you, honey. And really try to make these conversations happen. I know they're hard. It's like estate planning. Nobody wants to have the conversation. Look, when I die, this is how things are going to be laid out. But, you know, these conversations really will spare the surviving spouse a lot of anxiety at a time where, you know what, I got other things to worry about. I want to mourn my husband. I want to mourn my wife. I don't want to have to worry about money.
Now, what if the CFO partner is the one who's just not willing to sort of take the time to talk it through?
Well, that's when you put your foot down. And I actually have had that experience many times where someone will come in and the husband will say, you know, I didn't want to be here, but she wanted me to come in. And
I know
say,
what
oh,
I'm doing. Please
I know what I'm
alone.
Doing. And right. Of course you do, because, you know, you sit there and you say, look, just you. It doesn't cost anything but an hour of your time. Okay, so I was listening to the radio and these two women were talking on the air and I heard them talk about a 60-year-old woman. Well, that could be a 50-year-old woman. Right. I had a 36-year-old client who died and she hired me when she was given a terminal diagnosis so that I could work with her would then be surviving spouse, her husband, to help him manage their finances because he didn't do it. She did everything. Can you imagine me getting that call?
No.
Hi, I'm blank. I'm 36 years old. I've been diagnosed with terminal cancer, and I'd like to hire you to help me transition all these activities that I've been doing to my husband.
Wow.
It's intense, right?
It is intense.
And you know what? That is like the greatest gift that she could have given to him, because he even said in the aftermath, like, I don't know what I would have done if this was just dumped in my lap. I wouldn't have been able to do it.
Jill, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst for CBS News and a personal finance expert. Coming up, behavior modification, meet your paycheck.
The IDEAL program really does provide people with much more in the way of ongoing frequent feedback and rewards that happen in the present and not just in the future.
Losing weight with cash on the line, plus tech on the cheap. How to save next time you're looking to buy a new phone or camera. That's all coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. Money can motivate us in all sorts of ways, to do all sorts of things, including lose weight. Coming up, we'll talk with a behavioral economist about the way workplaces are using financial carrots and sticks to encourage us workers to get healthier. But first, we reached out to two Marketplace Money listeners who've had some success dieting for dollars, even when other diets have failed. Rob from Connecticut and Liz from Maryland. Hi, Rob. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
Hi.
Liz, you won your office contest. Tell me a little about it.
Essentially, I started a weight loss competition at my job as a way to kind of get myself out of a rut because it was winter and I had gained a considerable amount of weight over a short period of time. And although I was at that point finally motivated to get going, I felt I needed a little extra incentive to make it a bit more exciting, and then that's where the financial incentive idea came in.
How much weight did you lose? How did it feel to win?
Well, we did it on percent of body weight, and I ended up losing a little over 19%.
Congratulations.
Yes.
How did it feel to sort of step on the scale and have achieved that?
It really, at that point, became kind of a lifestyle change for me. At some point, it was kind of like, whether or not I win the money, I don't really care at this point because I've put in all this work and I'm really feeling good about myself.
And Rob, you're in the middle of your own challenge. Tell me, how's that one working?
Basically, every week I weigh in and if I've lost weight from the beginning of the competition, basically I have to, like, that sets a new kind of low for me to stay at. And if I go above that, then I have to pay $10 to a friend of mine for each week that I'm above kind of the low weight. And then he's holding the money. So it's been going on for a little less than a year now. So right now he's holding about $400.
Okay.
There's also additional penalties and things that total about another $300. So right now there's about $700 on the line. And I need to, in order to get that money back, I need to make it to my goal weight by November 27th.
And how's that looking?
It's going to be close. I have about 12 pounds to go.
You're competing against yourself, is
I
that
am.
Right?
Yep.
For both of you, money is at stake. Liz, you won $2,500, is that right?
That's right. That's with the company match. After the first few weeks we started the competition, my employer was supportive and gracious enough to sponsor the event because this was completely separate from any company initiative.
So Liz, $2,500. Rob, you've got about $700 on the line. How does money, has it factored in for you guys in making the changes that it takes to lose weight?
Well, for me, I think the thing that helped the most was that I was paying $5 a week at every weekly weigh-in, and that really forced me to, even though it was, you know, a relatively small amount of money, it really forced me to have to make a commitment, you know. I didn't want to keep losing $5 a week over the course of a few months. It really helped with the lifestyle change that I was going for at the time.
Yep, and I feel the same way, actually. Like, I think, especially, like, on the weekends, my weigh-ins were on Monday, so on the weekend when I was thinking about eating something, I would always think about kind of having to face the scale Monday morning, and if I wasn't good, having to pay the $10. And so that was kind of enough sometimes to, not always, obviously, because I have so much money in there now, but enough to at least give me pause. And then now that the way the money's accumulated, now it's enough money that really creates a pretty big incentive for me to try to be good until the end.
Have you guys tried in the past other ways to lose weight that didn't have money involved?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd like to think that it's not about the money, but in the times when you're getting tempted, when you see that donut sitting on the counter, I mean, you just think, you know, I would really like to win that money, you know?
I've had that exact kind of thought process as well. Like, you know, my wife sometimes will, she's a very good cook, unfortunately for me. And so, for example, the other night I came home and she had made pumpkin donuts. And, you know, I saw those and I was kind of like, you know, is this going to be worth $600? And I actually decided that it was worth it. So
you had
good.
A donut.
It was good. We'll see if I have to actually pay for it or not.
I have another question. I mean, the thing with dieting, in my experience with dieting, which I have some, is that you have to make the right choice over and over and over and over. You have to make the right choice every time you look at a piece of food. And that's hard.
Definitely for me, it's the fact that I kind of brought this competition home to my family. Like, my husband really helped me out a lot during this time. And he actually started his own little mini weight loss competition with a financial incentive at his workplace.
I've tried a bunch of different things over the years. And kind of the reason why I kind of ended up with the one that I'm doing now is that kind of the idea was hopefully that enough money would build up where it would create enough of an incentive for me to be able to make that kind of immediate choice of not to kind of eat the things that I have that I would usually want to eat. Like, I'm a big sucker for ice cream, for example. And so for me to not grab an ice cream cone or something on the way home, you know, it takes a lot of incentive. And actually, kind of the big critical moment for me that I think hopefully will turn the tide for me is that, like, I ultimately ended up just promising my wife that I would not, like, I would be absolutely perfect on the diet from here on out. And that's really the one thing so far that has really kind of made me not fudge it at all. Because sometimes when, you know, it's just one cookie won't hurt, or, you know, it's just an ice cream cone, you know, but like when I've made a promise to be absolutely good, you know, that's the thing that's kept me from kind of doing anything at all.
Rob in Connecticut and Liz in Maryland, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Employers are coming up with their own plans to get workers healthier. Just like Rob and Liz, they're using money as a motivation. But sometimes they're using threats of losing cash rather than rewards for good progress. Dr. Kevin Volpp is a professor at the Medical and Wharton Schools of the University of Pennsylvania. He's studied these workplace rewards programs. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to join you.
Why is this an area that workplaces are sort of getting involved in right now?
There's clearly been a shift in the last few years towards employers increasingly recognizing that the health habits of their employees are one of the top challenges to affordable benefits coverage. So I think that's really reason number one. Reason two relates to the sense that our health system really channels all the money, or nearly all the money, towards treating disease once people get sick. And I think there is a growing sense that we can probably do better than that by selectively focusing on programs that are successful in making people healthier and lowering their risk.
What sort of things are employers trying right now?
The most common approach we see is adjusting people's premiums based on outcome-based incentives such as body mass index, not smoking, blood pressure, cholesterol being below certain targets, or tying incentives to participation in various programs.
If somebody listening to the show right now isn't at a workplace that is doing this sort of thing and maybe doesn't have a workplace they go to at all, what can they learn from your research about how to do their own individual weight loss program?
I'm not sure we've seen great examples outside of research contexts in workplace settings that work very well. The IDEAL program really does provide people with much more in the way of ongoing frequent feedback and rewards that happen in the present and not just in the future.
And can you use financial incentives in sort of at the individual level? So I give myself $5 every time I go to the gym, something like that?
I think you could. We haven't seen people doing that successfully on their own in high numbers, at least not that has been reported in the literature. But there are a number of consumer sites that have cropped up on the web which try to help people set up those kind of programs. And I think the basic premise is probably common to many of them, that there are people who really want to lose weight and have, in fact, spent a lot of time, energy, money on trying to lose weight in the past and are willing to spend money on an incentive program that will provide some augmented motivation for themselves.
Now, you're a behavioral economist. Have you tried any of these tactics or strategies out on yourself in terms of changing your own behavior?
I've tried to keep it simple. So what I try to do is minimize carbohydrate ingestion, try to exercise frequently, eat lots of fruits and vegetables. And really, those three things are really all I do. I don't do any supplemental programs. I've never tried an incentive program on myself, although I've thought about it at various times.
What have you thought about trying to change?
Well, fortunately, I'm not somebody who's struggled a lot with my weight. That probably has more to do with my metabolism than any special personal characteristics or my underlying psychology. But I think that, you know, for everybody, there are different triggers, there are different challenges, and one of the keys is to really try to keep it simple, because I think sometimes people overwhelm themselves with trying to change everything in their lives. If you can substitute drinking zero-calorie beverages instead of regular soda, if you drink a lot of soda, that's going to reduce your caloric intake substantially.
Before I let you go, I want to ask about another good-for-us behavior, which it can be really hard to do, and that's saving money. And I think the government shutdown has maybe been a good reminder for all of us of the importance of an emergency fund. What do we know about the strategies out there that can help people save?
I think the most effective strategy, which has been found in behavioral economic work to be successful, is really changing the defaults of what people do in terms of savings, and particularly in the context of retirement savings. And the basic idea is that a lot of times when people are facing an important decision, they procrastinate because they want to think carefully about the pros and cons, carefully study all the options. And unfortunately, what often happens is that people never get around to making that decision. And so what the work in retirement savings has shown is that if you just change the percent of people's wages that come out of their paychecks automatically, people, once they make that decision, those change in defaults tend to be pretty sticky. And if 0% was coming out of your paycheck before, now it's 3%, now it's 5%, people tend to stick with that new default.
Dr. Kevin Volpe, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Sometimes I think of shopping as its own form of dieting. You have a limited budget, so why not skip the ice cream and save up that cash for something you'll enjoy a little longer? Maybe a shiny, sexy tablet or a new camera? We asked CNET's executive editor, Molly Wood, to give us tech on a budget tips. Thanks for joining us, Molly.
Happy to be here.
So let's say I really want a new tablet, but an iPad is just out of my price range. What are the other tablet alternatives out there?
Well, the good news is that there are a lot of them, and they're starting to sell in bigger and bigger numbers, probably because they're cheaper. For my money, though, the absolute best deal you can get on a tablet, whether it's 7 or 10 inches, is the Kindle Fire line. Those are extremely well-priced. It's about $200 for a 7-inch tablet, and I think $300 for a 10-inch tablet compared to $400 or $500 for an iPad.
Now, what am I going to lose if I go with the $200 Kindle Fire instead of an iPad?
Well, if you have a lot of media that you've already purchased from Apple, like if you've bought all your music from iTunes or you have a lot of movies and TV from iTunes, you won't be able to transfer those over. So if you're heavily invested in the Apple ecosystem already, it might be worth looking into a used iPad instead to save some money that way. Otherwise, you really won't lose much. It won't be the same experience if you're used to that sort of iOS.
The easy Apple interface.
Exactly. But Amazon has worked hard to make it very easy. And I actually think that you get a little bit more because you get that wonderful Amazon book library, all the instant video streaming that is free if you're a Prime member, and some other benefits of Android apps.
I wonder if we switch gears to smartphones. What are some good budget smartphones out there?
Again, the wonderful thing is that there are a million options in smartphones.
That's why you're here, to help us figure it out. Yes.
Exactly. And it can be a little bit tricky. If you're interested in Windows Phone at all, some of the Nokia Lumia phones are a really great deal. They're nice. The design is wonderful. The 920 in particular is $99 without a contract. Now, one thing that I really do like to shop for is older versions of phones. That, to me, is almost the best way to get a deal. If I'm shopping for a camera, I stock the release date of the newest version so that I can buy the one before.
Because you know it's going to fall.
Exactly. When it comes to iPhones in particular, the iPhone is a fantastic device going all the way back to the iPhone 4. And right now, you can get an iPhone 4 for free. You can get an iPhone 4S, sometimes for $49. The 4S, for my money, is one of the best iPhones out there. And if you can get that for $50, I see no reason, unless you really need 4G fast data, to get a 5 or a 5S.
So Apples can still make perfect sense on a budget.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the good things that Apple has done, is keep some of those older models around so that you can still find the 4S.
So I want to move on to headphones. I see ads all over Los Angeles for Beats headphones. People are wearing them in movies. They're $300. Are there better, less expensive headphone options out there?
There are many less expensive headphone options out there, to be sure. I would look at a brand called Shure, S-H-U-R-E. Shure headphones sound great. Our CNET editors always give them wonderful reviews, and they're much cheaper. The same pair that's $300 from Beats by Dre is going to be $100 from Shure. And it's really just a matter of doing some careful shopping. A lot of times our CNET editors will curate a list of the best headphones that always includes a budget option. And trust the user reviews that you see on CNET, that you see on Amazon. The users will always tell you if the headphone sound is good, because you don't want to, they're going to be honest about it. And so read the user reviews on a budget pair of headphones, and you'll usually find yourself in pretty good company.
Before I let you go, I wonder if you can just give me your favorite tech purchase right now for less than $50. Maybe make a good holiday present.
I'm going to go with a Roku.
A little Roku box for your television.
The Roku box. A Roku box for your television, to me, is one of the best buys available. It is $49, so I think it comes in
right
just
there.
Under $50. Just in under the wire. But it allows anyone to have streaming internet TV with just about the easiest interface possible. So they can get Netflix, they can get Hulu Plus, they can get YouTube, all in one place with a tiny little box that plugs right into the TV. Almost anybody can figure it out.
Other than price, what should a consumer know or be thinking about when they're looking to buy new tech?
I'm a big fan of buying last year's model at full price, mm-hmm. and then selling it a year later to get the next thing.
Molly Wood is executive editor of CNET. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And we've got a list of tech steals and splurges at marketplacemoney.org. That'll do it for Marketplace Money this week. Let us know what you think of the show on our website, marketplacemoney.org, or find us on Facebook. Next time, the college admissions arms race.
Well-to-do parents pay for college admissions guidance, they pay for essay writing, and they pay for test prep.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Lindsay Foster Thomas and Daryl Perinata, with help this week from Candice Manriquez, Raghu Manavalan, and Shay Huffman. Ravi Carmen is our engineer. Deborah Clark is the Marketplace Vice President and Executive Producer of the program. I'm Adrienne Hill. Thanks for listening.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.